Chapter 21. The door opened, and there appeared Morrison, looking breathless from her 3-foot walk from desk to door. She stepped to the side and said,
"Mr. Douglas Kemper and Mr. Wilson Sheen."
Two men walked past her and into the room. She hastily closed the door, but Archer did not hear her trademark heel clatter going away. He glanced at Dash, who was staring at the door and apparently thinking the very same thing. Dash moved slowly across the room to greet the men. Where he had been frenetic seconds before, Archer could see the man was now all cool, calm, and as collected as a preacher about to dispense an easy dose of religion and then follow that up with an ask for money.
"Gentlemen," he said, shaking their hands.
He motioned to the sitting area across from his desk.
"Please sit. Would you like something to drink? Coffee? Tea?"
Both men shook their heads, dutifully marched across the room, reached Archer, and stood there, each sizing him up.
Dash said, "This is my associate, Mr. Archer, just in town from working with the police in another state on a very important investigation. His former boss there is a good friend of mine and a fine police investigator. Archer will be truly helpful to me in this matter, and his discretion is legendary."
Archer returned his attention to Kemper and Sheen, looking them over as he shook their hands. Kemper was in his late 30s, an inch shorter than Archer, trim, good-looking, and well-groomed. Elegant was the descriptive term that came to Archer. His shoulders were narrow and his hips narrower still. His grip was a dish-rag clench. Whether that was for Archer's benefit or the man did that with everyone, Archer didn't know. He had a dark pencil mustache that matched his hair, which was slicked and parted and rode on his head like a flat crown. His eyes were green, and his manner seemed bored, as though what he was here for held no particular interest. He was dressed immaculately in a dark blue double-breasted worsted wool suit, framing a starched gray shirt so sparkling it looked like liquid chrome. His muted red and blue striped tie was double-knotted and held against his throat by a gold collar pin. He looked soft, but maybe wasn't, was Archer's conclusion. Wilson Sheen was a different sort altogether. He was around 5'8" and overweight, with a bulging gut that preceded him everywhere. He had broad shoulders and hips to match. His suit was light brown, single-breasted, with a dim blue shirt and a dark brown tie that rode uncomfortably against his meaty neck like a tree leaning into a hurricane. His pants were cuffed and pleated, and his shoes were scuffed fore and aft. His manner was as intense as Kemper's was indifferent. His ice-blue eyes raked across Archer. He drew in his nostrils like a scent dog. Archer took an instant dislike to the man, and then reprimanded himself. What would Irving Shaw say? Let it play out. Don't judge on emotion. Let the facts rule. Both men dropped their fedoras on the table and sat down. Dash and Archer joined them. Dash said,
"Everyone in Baytown knows who you are, Mr. Kemper. But for the sake of my new associate understanding things, perhaps you could start from the very beginning."
Kemper did not appear to like this suggestion, but he glanced at Sheen, who nodded in agreement. Kemper took out a gold cigarette case and pulled a gold-tipped cigarette from it. Sheen instantly lighted it with a gold-plated beauty of an igniter that was stamped with a name that to Archer looked French.
Golden boy all around, maybe.
Kemper primed his smoke, sucked in a long one, and let it gush out both nostrils like steam from a train coming right at Archer. In a smooth, bored voice, he said,
"It's like this, Archer. I'm running for mayor of Baytown. Wilson is my right-hand man in my business, and also my campaign manager. I was chairman of the town council for 2 years, and was content with that, but a number of very smart, important people asked me to consider running for mayor, and I decided to do just that. We're growing fast, and a steady hand is needed to manage that growth. Otherwise, it can get out of whack."
"And we don't need a dentist in charge,"
chimed in Sheen. While Kemper's voice was silk, Sheen's was like a bulldozer. It banged off all four walls of the office and fell on them like mustard gas.
"Yes, well," said Kemper, tapping ash into a blue ashtray set on the table. "As far as personal history, I married into a very prominent family, the Armstrongs. My wife is Beth Armstrong Kemper.
When Archer made no reply to this, Dash said,
"For generations, the Armstrong family dominated the cattle business around here, which made money hand over fist. They were astute enough to get out of it before the whole industry went down to nothing. And they used those funds to basically invest in and expand Baytown, a large part of which they still own. Sawyer Armstrong is Beth's father, and the richest man in town."
"I drove down Sawyer Avenue coming into town," noted Archer. Kemper blew smoke to the ceiling as he crossed his legs, showing off canary yellow socks, and swished his tasseled loafer like a leather metronome. "Sawyer loves to make his presence felt wherever he can. Naming the best and most beautiful boulevard in the town after himself was one way to do that. Hell, I'm surprised we're not called Sawyerville or Armstrongburg. If I win the election, he might just insist I do it." Archer continued to watch as Sheen touched Kemper's sleeve and shot his boss a look of caution. Kemper said, in a more controlled tone that would work well on the political stump, "He's really made this place what it is. I have to give him that. We're not always on the same page about what direction the town should go in now, but that's to be expected. But I value his opinion."
"And the matter that has brought you here," said Dash.
Kemper glanced at Sheen before lighting another cigarette, this time with his own lighter. He took so long doing it that Archer could have rolled two of his own and smoked them both down. Kemper was apparently a man used to taking his time, and used to people allowing him to do it, thought Archer. "Yes, well, this must remain confidential, of course."
"Once the retainer is signed and money exchanged, privilege attaches," said Dash. "I've already communicated my rates to you."
Kemper gave him a once-over sneer. "Look, Willie, you'll get your damn money, all right? Don't put the squeeze on me from the get-go. It affronts my sensibilities, to the extent that I have any left. It's a damn nuisance that I have to do this at all. It's ridiculous, in fact, but I have been persuaded that it's in my interest to do so." "By the very important smart people," noted Archer. Kemper turned his gaze to him and smiled. "It's difficult to say no to such influence."
Dash said, "I'm sure I'll get the money, Mr. Kemper, as privilege attaches at that time. But that doesn't get us to the heart of the problem. You came here to ask us to help you get answers, solve your dilemma. The money obviously is secondary to that. Or am I being off base?"
Archer eyed Kemper and saw the hostility fade in the latter's eyes. Kemper said, "No, you're doing okay." He impatiently stubbed out his newly lit smoke. "Well, let me get to the point then, gentlemen. I received this in the mail." He took an envelope from his jacket pocket and handed it to Dash. Archer slid closer so he could read it as well. "There was no return address and no signature, of course," added Kemper. It wasn't a long letter, and after both men read it, Dash looked up and said,
"Okay, we're talking blackmail. If you don't drop out of the race for mayor, details of an affair between you and a Miss Ruby Fraser who works at Midnight Moods will be made public."
He glanced at Archer.
"That's the burlesque place on the edge of town."
"Yeah, I heard of it. I have a friend who might try to get a job there." Dash gave him a puzzled look.
"You make friends fast, Archer."
"She actually drove out here with me."
"Right," said Dash, before turning to Kemper. "Do you know this Miss Fraser?"
"I know her."
"How well?"
"Not nearly as well as they claim in the letter."
"So no affair?"
said Dash.
"No."
"If there's no truth to it, why worry?" said Archer. Kemper snapped. "Because the damage will be done. I'll get creamed in the election. Women can vote, Archer, and they won't vote for an alleged philanderer." Dash interjected.
"So our means of attacking this sucker are limited, but they're still there."
Kemper sat back. "And pray tell, what might those be?" Sheen interjected.
"You're not going to suggest paying off the blackmailer?"
"There's no such thing as paying off a blackmailer," replied Dash. "They just keep coming back. You might as well open a bank account for them to access."
"So what then?" asked Kemper.
"Any idea who's behind this?"
asked Dash. "I might have some ideas."
"Then let us have them."
"What would you do with that information?"
asked Sheen quickly.
"Both sides can play the game," said Dash.
"Meaning?" said Kemper sharply, his indifferent manner vanishing. Archer piped in. Meaning you fight fire with fire. If what they say about you isn't true but is still potentially damaging, then the same holds for them.
And if their reputation means nothing to them?
Inquired Kemper.
Easy to say, another to endure, replied Dash.
Kemper tap-tapped his ash.
Okay, we can provide you with a list later this afternoon. Once we put it together, I'll have Wilson send it over. It will be a short one, probably, and there's no guarantee that the real culprit is on there.
It's still a good place to start, said Dash. But you have to be prepared for them making this public if you don't pay, or if blackmail is not their intent.
You mean they might just want to smear Douglas and make him lose the election?
Suggested Sheen.
Maybe,
said Dash, keeping his gaze on Kemper. The man sat forward, his brow furrowed.
Look, Willie, the last thing I want is for my wife to find out about this garbage in some cheap paper. She's just recovering from an illness. She doesn't need this on top of it.
What illness? I hadn't heard.
Appendicitis. She had an operation. In fact, the doc in this building performed it. He handles the whole family.
Right, O'Donnell. He's very good. It's always surprised me he stayed here. He makes enough money to rent on the other side of Sawyer Ave. I hope she's going to be okay.
She will. Beth's strong, but this won't help.
We'll do all we can to keep it under wraps.
A moment later, there was a knock at the door, and Morrison entered with a sheaf of papers.
Mr. Kemper, said Dash, eyeing Morrison, you can sign off on the retainer, get your duplicate copy, and then leave the check with Miss Morrison, and we can get to work.
The election is in 4 weeks,
Sheen told him. Dash offered up a smile.
Then, by God, we haven't a moment to waste.
Kemper rose and joined Morrison over at the desk where he signed the papers, as did Dash. Archer came over to stand next to the desk. Kemper took his duplicate copy and passed it over to Sheen, who had risen and joined him. It was Sheen who took out a checkbook and made out the retainer check in the amount of $1,000, signing it with a flourish. He handed it to Dash. Archer saw that it was drawn on an account in the name of Kemper for Mayor. Dash said,
expenses are, of course, separate and will be itemized and sent to you regularly.
Kemper glanced at Dash and then at Archer.
Oh, joy. I wish you both luck in this endeavor.
He and Sheen picked up their hats and left. Dash turned to Morrison, passed her the check, and said urgently,
okay, hon, carry that down to the bank and get it deposited ASAP. Then go over the list of outstanding bills, prioritize and whittle, stiff who you can, and negotiate the must-pays down as best you can. In the future, I'll need credit, and this is where I build it back up.
Morrison nodded, glanced anxiously at Archer, and hurriedly left. A few moments later, Archer heard the office door open and close. Dash plucked a briarwood pipe from a stand on his desk, stuffed it with tobacco pulled from a pouch in his desk drawer, and took a moment to light it, puffing thoughtfully. He settled back on the davenport and glanced at Archer.
Well?
Asked Dash. Archer said, a dentist in charge? What did Sheen mean by that?
Kemper's running against a fellow named Alfred Drake, who's a dentist. But he's no dummy. And Drake's been on the town council for years. He knows the difference between floating a water bond and filling up a pool with water.
Nice of Kemper to provide a list of possible suspects. Dash lit his pipe again and sucked on the end to prime it.
The list, if we get it, will be worthless. He'll put on there anyone he has a grudge against, hoping we can find dirt on them, whether it has anything to do with the election or not.
But if the truth won't set Kemper free, what will?
I'll tell you what, Archer. For $1,000 plus expenses, we will.
Dash stood and said,
now, follow me.
Chapter 22 Dash led Archer out the door, past Morrison's empty desk, and over to another door on the other side of the reception area that Archer had missed seeing before. Dash opened the door and turned on the light. A long, naked tube hissed and popped overhead before gaining purchase and staying on, feebly illuminating the small space so it looked like a partially exposed photograph. Archer looked around and took in the room that held a desk, a chair, another chair, a 3-drawer metal file cabinet, and one window about as wide as his head. Dash swept a hand across the space.
You're no office, Archer.
So I have the job, then?
Not if you continue to be that slow on the uptake. Now, it's a little dusty, but I can get Connie to spruce it up a bit. Maybe get a fresh flower for that vase over there.
No, that's okay. I can clean it up.
You sure?
Archer surveyed his office. Pretty sure, yeah.
PIs don't spend a lot of time on their duff in their office, Archer,
Dash said warningly. Give me a sec to breathe it all in, Mr. Dash. Then I'll be raring to go. Dash smiled.
Well, first thing, not even my old man was Mr. Dash. I'm Willie, capiche?
Got it, Willie. So do we wait on the list from Kemper?
I don't like depending on clients for answers. If they can do it themselves, I might as well put myself in a coffin and pay the digging fee up front.
But if we find the blackmailer, what can we really do?
Dirt, Archer. It sticks both ways, like you said. And I've never met anyone who didn't have something they'd prefer other people didn't know.
So is Kemper the favorite in the race?
By a wide margin, yes. He's young, handsome, wealthy, smart, smooth as silk. Pure class, as I'm sure you saw for yourself. For a minute there, I thought I was talking to Errol Flynn. Alfred Drake looks like a day-old cadaver by comparison.
And so Kemper married into a wealthy family. Talk about good fortune raining down.
Well, Kemper looks like he was always rich. In fact, his father came from money. Then he blew it all, and Kemper went from being a rich kid to a poor adult. But he worked hard. Yeah, he married well, but the guy isn't afraid of work, I'll give him that.
And Sawyer Armstrong?
Armstrong is a son of a bitch. But he's a cunning son of a bitch.
And his daughter?
She's cut from the same wood, but she's more nuanced than her old man, and Armstrong can be subtle when the need arises.
Do you believe Kemper about there being nothing between him and Frazier?
Yeah, and I believe that Dewey beat Truman. Assume the worst of your clients, Archer, and you'll never be disappointed. They don't come to us because they're good little boys. They come because they screwed up and they want us to clean the mess.
He pointed to the desk.
In one of them drawers is a little notepad and a pen. Take them with you and write stuff down. Memory makes mistakes. What you write down is a lot better.
Archer got the pad and pen, and he and Dash went back to the reception area. Dash plucked his fedora off the hook and said,
Hey, you got a car?
That's outside.
Good, mine's in the shop.
What's wrong with it?
Nothing that paying the money owed won't fix.
What model is it?
A 1942 Lincoln Continental Cabriolet. The prettiest blue with a canvas top and fat white walls. Did you know 1942 was the last year Detroit made cars before the war intervened?
Nope.
After that, the big boys turned to the war effort, building trucks, tanks, planes. My ride was one of the last off the assembly line before Detroit turned to being the engine of the arsenal of democracy, as Roosevelt termed it.
Car's nearly 8 years old, then. You looking for a new ride?
Dash frowned. You don't let a filly go when she's just starting to hit her stride.
Miss Morrison seems efficient. Dash gave him a nuanced look.
And I'm sure Earl told you we were married and are now divorced.
He did mention that. Surprised you two can still work together.
We always worked together just fine. It was marriage together that didn't work.
Okay.
You got a heater?
Dash asked abruptly. Not on me, no. Archer followed Dash back to his office. Out of a desk drawer, Dash drew a Colt 38 and a leather belt holster.
Irv said you were in the army and know your way around a piece.
I'm sure you do, too.
I do, but at this point in my life I'd rather think than shoot. So clip it on and don't pull it unless you're gonna use it.
By the way, what's my salary? And how often do I get paid?
Don't go too fast, Archer. Let's take it nice and slow. I need to see you in action first.
They rode the elevator down. Earl gazed up at Dash, the grin stretching to both cheeks and maybe beyond.
You going to work, Mr. Dash? Going to get yourself some criminal?
That's the plan, Earl.
Saw Miss Morrison run out of here with a check in hand. She going to the bank, I expect?
You'd make a good Seamus.
Can't lose you, Mr. Dash. You're the only one takes the elevator, except this young man here. I'd be out of a job.
Uh-huh. Well, we don't want that to happen.
Outside, Archer said,
Is he always like that with you?
Like what?
I don't know. Gushing.
Hell, Archer, the man hates my guts.
How do you know that?
No man ever went to prison who comes out liking the man who put him behind bars.
So did you get him the job here because you keep your enemies close?
I felt for the guy, but he'd stick a knife in my back in a New York minute.
When Dash saw the Delahaye, he stopped and stared suspiciously at Archer.
This your car?
Yep.
He read off the name.
Delahaye?
It's French.
The hell you say.
As he started to get in, he stopped.
Steering wheel's on the wrong side.
Don't worry, I'm getting the hang of it. By the way, where are we going, Willie?
Straight to the source, Archer. To talk to Ruby Frazier.
You think she'll cop to blackmailing Kemper?
She's not blackmailing anybody. She's what you call a pawn. I don't expect her to be honest, don't get me wrong. Midnight Moods doesn't care about honest people. They just want gals with long legs and big tits. Miss Ruby isn't quarterbacking this one.
So Kemper's enemies?
Or his friends?
Friends who are enemies, then?
Do you know of any other kind, son? Because I sure as hell don't.
Chapter 23 As they were heading out of town, Dash pointed to a large billboard.
There's our man.
Douglas Kemper's face was about 10 feet tall. He was looking off into the distance, his expression intelligent, visionary even. Next to this profile was the slogan, Kemper for Mayor, a man for our times.
Catchy, said Archer dryly as they passed by and drove north.
A half hour later they arrived at their destination. Midnight Moods looked to Archer like every shallow fantasy a man could reasonably expect to have in his life. Constructed like a faux castle, complete with turrets and towers, bastions and battlements, the high walls covered with enormous posters of the most beautiful women wearing the most alluring outfits that Archer had ever seen. The place had a vibrant view of the nearby salty ocean. Its large asphalt parking lot held about 30 cars, from junkers to lean rides, to police prowlers, to a couple of Bentleys, though it was still the afternoon. As they pulled to a stop, Archer ran his gaze over the front of the place once more and said, Who the hell built this thing?
Who do you think? Sawyer Armstrong. He's the only man around with the sawbucks to put up a joint like this.
When did he do it?
During the war. Sawyer has X-ray vision when it comes to seeing opportunities and making money off poor saps who don't have a lot of it but don't mind spending what they do have. It's volume that matters.
And where did that volume come from? This isn't exactly New York City.
Trains full of soldiers came through here, Archer. Sawyer put this place up in 6 months and made a fortune and then some for about 3 years just off the GIs.
And now? How's business?
Popular as all get out. Lots of young guys and older gents coming through looking for something new.
He paused.
But in the long run, who knows?
Meaning?
Baytown is turning into something that tends to shun places like this.
What's that?
Baytown is doing its best to turn respectable. But there will always be an audience for this sort of thing, even if wives and girlfriends show up here from time to time to make their feelings known, sometimes with an iron skillet in hand and not caring who they hit with it.
You ever been here? Asked Archer.
A few times. Some laughs, some drinks, nothing more.
How many times did Connie Morrison crack you in the head with her skillet?
I'm starting to like you, Archer, but don't make it personal.
They climbed out and crossed over a short wooden bridge that spanned a fake moat that was filled with not water, but gravel. There were chains on either side of the bridge that ran to some wheels affixed to the outside wall of the place.
They ever raise the drawbridge? Asked Archer.
Yeah, every night after the last penniless drunk falls out the door.
Inside it was dark, quiet, and, at least to Archer, palpably ominous, until a woman in her late 40s came to greet them. She was dressed in a long, dark gown and wearing red high heels that drove her height to a head above Dash's. Her hair was platinum with darker roots, her skin white as cream. Her lipsticked mouth housed a smile as wide as her face, but it never once reached her baby blues. She smelled of talcum powder and ginger.
"Can I help you, gentlemen? We're not quite open yet. The sun's still up."
"The front door was wide open," pointed out Dash.
"They lowered the bridge to let the beer, wine, and liquor deliveries through."
"And all those cars in the parking lot are..."
"Just visitors,"
she replied, keeping her tone and expression professional.
"The performers live here."
"You mean the female performers?"
"Do I? And what business is that of yours, Mr.?"
Dash pulled out his ID card and flashed it for her.
"Willie Dash, P.I. My associate Archer here. We'd like to talk to Ruby Frazier."
The woman eyed the card.
"Gumshoes at midnight moods. My, my."
"And you are?" asked Archer.
"I would be Mabel Dawson, sonny boy. I manage this place. At least the girl part of it."
Dash said,
"Speaking of girls, is Ruby here?"
"Why do you want to see Ruby?"
"It's confidential. She should be expecting us," Dash lied.
"Is that a fact? She never mentioned it to me."
"That's because it's confidential," said Archer. "While you're getting her, mind if we look around?"
"Yes, I would mind. And who said I was getting Ruby, handsome?"
"Any reason why you won't?" asked Dash.
"I can think of about 10, and I can call the cops if this turns into harassment."
"Why bother the cops with something so trivial? We'll talk to Ruby, and then we'll leave. Nice and simple, no trouble to anyone," said Dash.
"I don't have to do nothing except ask you to leave."
She tacked on a smile as though she were enjoying all this.
"So scram."
"But I do know things about this place," added Dash, looking around. "Like, why have the bridge down at this hour?"
"I told you, Buster, for deliveries. You want to see the booze for yourself?"
"I happen to know that your deliveries come in the morning, and through the tradesman entrance on the side."
"Like I said, we have the bridge down for the visitors to our performers. They're entitled to have visitors, aren't they?"
"Sure, but they're not entitled to get paid for it, if you know what I mean."
"I really have no idea what you're getting at."
"Would Ruby be engaged in the thing you have no idea what I'm getting at?"
She pursed her lips and said indignantly,
"Prostitution is illegal, Mr. Dash."
"Lots of things are illegal, and that just makes some people want to do them even more. And there are prowlers out there, so I guess I'll include the cops in that."
Dawson bristled slightly.
"Ruby's a good girl."
A chrome cigarette case appeared from down her bosom, and Archer lit up her smoke when she beckoned him with a generous glance to do so. She drew in the smoke deeply.
"You really just want to talk to her?"
"We do."
She slid a hand along Dash's face.
"You wouldn't lie to me, would you, mister? I don't like men who lie to me, and most of them do. So that's why I don't like most men."
"Not on your life would I lie to you, Miss Dawson."
She lightly slapped his pudgy face.
"Right."
She glanced upward.
"Is that rug on tight enough for you? It can get sort of rough sailing inside here."
Dash tapped his toupee and said,
"I never get seasick."
"Hey, you boys packing?"
"And if we were?"
"Just asking."
"Good for you. Nice to be curious, ain't it, Archer?"
"Follow me then, gents. Watch your footing. They haven't brought the fire hoses through yet to clean up from last night's rummies. Would it surprise you that I don't touch the stuff myself?"
She eyed Archer when she said these words, running her gaze from top to bottom in a way that made Archer feel like she had peeled off all his clothes.
"Apparently nothing could surprise me about you, Miss Dawson," replied Archer.
"Brawn and brains. And here I'd just about given up all hope."
Chapter 24. They headed down a long hall and then walked up 3 flights of thickly carpeted stairs. They passed a sand bucket under a spooled fire hose. Archer noted it was filled with discarded cigarette butts. If the place caught fire, the sand probably would too.
"Is that reefer, or has my sense of smell gone to hell?" said Dash.
"Marijuana is illegal, Mr. Dash,"
said Dawson.
"Yeah, just like prostitution. And make it Willie. We're friends now.
They reached the end of the hall and walked up one last set of stairs that carried them to the very top of Midnight Moods.
Only the best room in the house for the kid, I see, said Dash. Nosebleed seats. Can't see home plate from here, no sir.
In this setup, you work your way down, not up, Willie,
retorted Dawson. She led them to a scarred door painted black. On a stiff card inserted in a brass holder was written, Ruby Fraser. Dawson knocked and called out,
Ruby! You decent? Two gumshoes here to talk to you. One's old and chubby with a rug on top, and one's tall and could give Clark Gable a run for it. I'll leave it to you to decide which one to concentrate your efforts on.
They heard footsteps approach, hesitant, maybe fearful, thought Archer. The door opened, and there she was, looking like a Conover model, all tall and long-limbed, and supple and fresh-faced and innocent and violet-eyed. She had on silk pajamas, a top and a bottom that was a good 2 inches too short for her, and revealed long, pale feet with nails painted a dull red. She was maybe all of 20, and maybe not even that yet. She looked from Dawson to Dash to Archer, holding on him, and her lips curled ever so slightly upward as she did so.
Yes?
Her voice was surprisingly deep, thought Archer.
These gents want to talk to you, Ruby. They're private eyes.
Archer thought their appearance might knock this lady for a loop. However, her smile deepened. But when he looked at her eyes more closely, he saw an unnatural languidness there. A bullet jacket with no bullet in it. She opened the door further and stepped back, motioning them in. Dawson looked at them.
I'll leave you to it, then.
She walked off.
I'm Ruby Fraser,
she said, holding out her hand for them to shake.
We know. That's why we're here, said Dash, shaking her hand.
He looked at Archer.
Pull out the notepad and pen, Archer. I'm sure Ruby has lots to tell us.
Archer did as Dash had asked. He looked around and noted that the room was small, with a pale blue davenport on one side and a dormant electric heater on the other. Against another wall was a built-in breakfast nook. A small black Emerson radio sat on a side table. It hummed low, like she might have just turned down the volume. Next to it was an ashtray stand with a burning stub resting in it. A small fan sat on the floor lazily pushing the air from one side to the other, like a cat leisurely flicking its tail.
What do you do for food in this joint? Asked Dash,
taking a seat in a chintz chair, the only one in the room.
Got another room over there with a little icebox and a hot plate, and a table and two chairs. Room next to it has a Murphy bed and a closet. But mostly I go downstairs for meals. Food's not bad. In fact, it's pretty good.
Toilet?
Down the hall. We take turns with the shower, me and three other girls.
Good to know, said Dash. Take a seat on the davenport and let's have a little chat.
She did so. An Archer leaned against the wall with his notepad and pen. The woman was calm, patient, and unmoved. All things she shouldn't have been with them. The room had a scent to it other than the cigarettes. He eyed her clothes. The pajamas were polka-dotted and looked like a man's outfit, wide in the shoulders, narrow in the hips. He wondered where she had gotten them. Not from Kemper, they were too short for him.
What is it that you do here, Ruby? Asked Dash.
I sing and dance and do skits, and I work with Ralph Jeffries. He's good, showing me the ropes. He was in vaudeville before the war. You know him?
Dash shook his head.
Where are you from?
Illinois.
Chicago?
Never been to Chicago. I usually tell people I'm from Peoria, because that was the closest big city to where I'm from. But I've never been there neither.
What are you doing out here?
Looking for something besides Peoria.
Archer noted that she put her hand to her mouth while speaking. When she removed it, he noted the line of yellowed, uneven teeth, with scraggly points at either end. Archer said,
You sticking around here long, Miss Fraser?
Just call me Ruby. Long enough to learn my craft, that's what they call it. Then I'm off to Hollywood. I want to be in pictures. Soon as I get my teeth fixed, I'm saving up.
She now opened her mouth wide to show them.
Hollywood, huh? Said Archer. That seems to be going around like the flu. Douglas Kemper, said Dash.
What about him?
So you know him?
He comes here pretty regular. They have a card club here. He's a member.
Card club? Said Archer. Dash said, California doesn't allow casino gambling like they do in Nevada, Archer. They used to have gambling ships just past the 3-mile mark, but before the war, a state attorney general by the name of Earl Warren, who is now our esteemed governor, got them outlawed. Now the card clubs are the only game in town, unless you're into horse racing, which is allowed as well. But isn't card playing still gambling? There's no house to play against. The players are pitted against one another. How does the house make money, then? Various fees. Players pay for their seats. They pay by the hand. Things like that. The house provides the space, the dealer, the cashier. They make good money. The clubs are real popular. The one here does very well. The more players, the more money you make. Frazier said,
Mr. Kemper is married to some important lady, so I hear. He's very nice.
How nice, meaning to you, said Dash. She picked up the lit stub and took a long drag on it, shooting both men probing looks.
Who wants to know?
For starters, I do, and maybe Mrs. Kemper, the very important lady. She looked relieved.
She's got nothing to worry about. He's a perfect gentleman.
Then you have no idea who might be claiming that Kemper and you are far more than friends? She presented him with a knife-sharp glare.
What are you trying to pull here, mister? Who says that?
Mr. Kemper has received a blackmail demand, and you figure prominently in it.
Well, I don't know nothing about that. Sweet Jesus.
Then if someone asked, you'd say that there was nothing there?
That's what I'm telling you. That's what I'd tell anybody who asked.
I need you to tell me that you're speaking the truth.
I am. I never slept with Mr. Kemper, swear to God.
Okay, Archer, you got that? Archer nodded. Got it. Swear to God. Okay, the next time we come back, it'll be with an affidavit for you to sign. Do you know what an affidavit is? She shook her head. Well, it's a document where you tell the truth and then sign it to make it official. Then if you change your story, it can be used against you.
Well, why would anyone want to sign that?
She asked. They can also help you, but only if you're telling the truth. And since you are, there's no problem, right? Said Archer. She didn't respond. She just looked at Archer like he was the last thing standing between her and death row. Dash rose. One more thing. How much do you make here?
$100 a week, room and board included. Most dough I ever made. Why?
Just setting a baseline, Ruby, that's all.
I don't get it.
I suppose not. You're not thinking of leaving town anytime soon? She eyed him like a chicken did a fox.
I don't know. Should I?
Not till you hear from me, no. But if I do tell you to go, Ruby, you need to go like nobody's business.
You're scaring me.
Good. Then I'm getting my point across. He added, maybe we'll be back to take in your show. What time does it start?
10 o'clock sharp.
I'll have to take a nap. You be a good girl, Ruby, and we'll get through this. Downstairs, Dash made a call from the front office of Midnight Moods to Connie Morrison, and then waited for a few minutes for her to ring him back with an answer. After that, as they were leaving, Archer said, Do you believe her? I'm not sure. What I am sure about is that she's a drug user. Archer looked startled. How do you know? The eyes don't lie. From the looks of her, I'd say opium. Don't think she's taken heroin yet. Hope she never does. That's the difference between getting shot with a .22 and a bazooka. Where are we off to now? The next piece of the puzzle, Archer. Mrs. Kemper? Dash gave him an admiring look. You might just make a decent gumshoe after all. Chapter 25 Archer drove back toward town, and then up a road that zigzagged as they passed canyons with clefts that crept through the rock like capillaries inside the body. As they reached a plateau in the rise,
and the ground flattened out like a skillet. He was then directed by Dash to pass through a pair of impressive wrought iron gates embossed with the letter A in scrollwork that appeared when the gates were closed and the two halves came together. The gates were mounted on two enormous stone columns. With the ocean on the left and the foothills of the St. Inez Mountains on the right, the Delahaye roared along on a curved, pale cobblestone road. The trees up here were lush and covered the ground like a vast, decamped army. 50-foot-tall live oaks with their jumble of branches lined their way. Spanish moss hung off them like veils on blushing brides. This botanical spectacle held forth until they rounded a bend where the columns of trees retreated. There, the greenest, widest patch of grassy lawn Archer had ever seen commenced. It led up to a peninsula of land on which sat a long two-story structure that was built of limestone block, round gray and brown stone, and other elements thrown in for interesting architectural measure. A sea of French doors ran along the front and were anchored by a pair of massive wrought iron doors with impressive scrollwork that served as the main entrance. On either side of them were lit gas lanterns about the size of Archer's torso, and still they seemed small next to the doors. Thick, plush, variegated ivy covered much of the home's lower front facade. Throughout the landscape were well-tended flower beds, creating patterns of color, green hedges, and lush topiary bushes set in either pots or the ground. It was an idyllic setting, powered by money, and presumably a lot of it, along with a ton of sweat labor. As they turned and came up the long drive running along the face of the house, Archer got a glimpse of the rear grounds, which faced the ocean and held a stunning vista of the Pacific. There was a tennis court with a tented seating area on one side and an oval-shaped pool with deep, dark blue water on the other. A long stone wall ran along the rear perimeter of the property, which presumably ended in a cliff. The Pacific stretched out nearly 1,000 feet below, like a private body of water. Next, he looked at a large metal-roofed barn from which two men in denim work clothes were coming out, while another man pushed a wheelbarrow full of brush. A fourth man hosed down a dark blue Triumph Roadster with its canvas top up. A green John Deere tractor sat idle near the barn. A man had the engine cover open and was tinkering with the motor. Archer pulled to a stop in the paved motor court next to a red and black Bentley, with a topless front compartment for the chauffeur. Next to that was a silver and black Rolls-Royce Phantom. As Dash got out, he said,
"Hey, now your ride's in good company."
"I'd say so," replied Archer. "Nice place the Kempers have."
"Didn't you note the letter A on the gates? Sawyer Armstrong built this place for his daughter as a wedding present, but couldn't resist putting his name on it."
Dash breathed in the sea air that rose up from below like it had taken an express elevator car to get there.
"Smell that, Archer?"
"Yeah, fish.
Bet you never seen a house this big before."
"I have."
"Get out of here. You're having one on me."
"The one I saw back in Polka City was bigger than this place, but not by much. But it was also phony, and so were the people in it. The jury's still out on this one."
"It won't be much longer, but I wouldn't call Beth Kemper a phony."
"How do you know she'll see us?"
"I phoned Connie from Midnight Moods and had her set up an appointment. She called back to confirm it. That's what I was waiting on."
They walked up to the massive double front doors. They, too, were embossed with an A, but here each door held its own letter. Archer said,
"Boy, the guy likes to remind people of the origins of this place."
Dash said,
"For me, it's a sign of insecurity, but I could be wrong."
He poked at a buzzer. From somewhere distant, they heard the peal of a bell, its sound dulled by distance. About 20 seconds later, footsteps approached. The opening door revealed a Chinese man, who wore a waist-long white tuxedo jacket, black pants with lighter black stripes down the sides of the trousers, and a bow tie the color of the pants. His skin was tanned, and he had 3 moles that marched across his forehead like a line of ants. His dark hair was trimmed with silver at the temples, like the best character actors in the movies, and was slicked back. He had a long, tapered mustache that dovetailed around his mouth and ended in a stringy goatee. He had the sort of face that made it hard to guess the correct age. Archer put the range at 40 to 60.
Willie Dash and Archer to see Mrs. Kemper. We're expected.
May I see identification, please?
Oh, so you're one of those butlers. Okay, pal. Feast your eyes.
Dash held out his ID card, and the man examined it long enough to have copied out all the information it contained three times over. He handed it back and motioned them in. He closed the door, and they followed him down a marble hall that had a cushiony oriental rug running right down the middle of it for what seemed like miles. The walls were festooned with enough paintings that Archer could have been forgiven for believing he had mistakenly stepped into a museum. They passed large rooms that were all furnished with just the right amount of furniture and not a smidgen more. White, gray, and pale blue were the dominant colors. Archer could see how that scheme would play well off the California sun that was streaming in through all the windows and French doors that also lined the rear of the home. The interior was as quiet as a tomb, and nearly as joyful, Archer thought as he walked next to Dash. Even with all the beautiful things, he couldn't imagine living here. The man stopped at double-curved doors made of walnut, which shone with elbow-greased polish, and knocked on one of them.
All right,
said the voice within. To Archer it sounded dulled and joyless, like a knife blade left outside to rust. He steeled himself to meet Beth Armstrong Kemper. Chapter 26. The man opened the door and stepped to the side for them to pass through. They did so, and he closed the door, and Archer heard his soft footsteps moving away. Archer glanced around the room. He didn't have to be a world-class Seamus to deduce that this was the library. Three walls of floor-to-ceiling shelves bursting with books would have been his first and only necessary clue. The carpet was white with subtle dashes of orange and muted teal, done up in a breaking wave pattern. It felt deep and springy, like he was standing on a trampoline. The furniture was large and tasteful and well laid out over the room's expanse. A fireplace at one end was mounted in stone and topped by a mantel consisting of one enormous worm-eaten piece of blackened and distressed timber that someone could have built a boat out of with wood left over. Despite the warmth outside, it was deliciously cool in here, and a small fire flickered in the hearth. There were two camel-haired wing-back chairs set in front of the fireplace. One of them was occupied. When Beth Kemper rose and turned to them, Archer had to catch his breath and almost dropped the notepad and pen he'd taken from his pocket. She was not the most beautiful woman, or the one with the finest figure he had ever seen, yet he wasn't sure he had ever been in the presence of a lovelier woman, and right now he couldn't explain the distinction. It was just a feeling, an overpowering one. She was tall and slim, with blonde hair that had not come out of the bottle. It skimmed her shoulders like a shade tree does its underlings. Her skin wasn't pale in keeping with her hair. It had a healthy glow that radiated right up to her eyes, which were cornflower blue, but seemed enhanced by something inside the woman that transformed soft cornflower into electrically charged sapphires. Her features were classical in the sense that there wasn't a flaw to be detected or criticized. The cheek bumps, the jawline, the slender, plumb, line-straight nose, the shallow sockets the eyes rested in, the high forehead without trace of wrinkle or brow furrow, all seemed molded by the sure hand of a sculptor intent on perfection, or at least most people's view thereof. She was dressed simply in a lavender day dress that dropped straight down her tall frame, with a strip of white around the neck and also at the ends of the elbow-length sleeves. The hemline just touched her knees. She wore a strand of small pearls, a platinum-engraved wrist cuff, and white unadorned heels of simple, elegant design. Her engagement and wedding rings were the stuff of royalty, thought Archer. He also observed that Beth Kemper had the weary expression of a woman who wished to tolerate others only on her terms, but had never yet been afforded that singular opportunity. He figured she couldn't be much older than he was, maybe 30 at the most.
"Gentlemen,"
she said, her voice bubbling like a brook, but he thought that might be just for a certain effect.
"Mrs. Kemper, I'm Willie Dash. You might remember me. Our paths have crossed at certain functions from time to time.
This is my associate, Archer. Kemper barely looked at Dash.
Is Archer your surname or given one?
She asked. For a moment, Archer couldn't remember the answer. He twirled his hat in his hands, a trait of his when nervous, and said, Archer's my last name.
And your Christian name?
Aloysius. She nodded, satisfied, and motioned to the two chairs while she stood with her back to the fire.
Yes, Mr. Dash, I do remember you. You and my father go way back.
After they sat, Dash said,
We've known each other a long time, yes.
To the extent that anyone really knows my father.
Yes, ma'am, I understand what you mean. He and I have butted heads a few times, and I can't say I understand him any better now than I did then.
Then you and I have something in common.
Yes, ma'am.
Would you like something to drink? A bit early in the day, but I'm having one if that influences your decision.
It was then that Archer saw the bar set up a few paces from the fireplace and on the same wall.
Bourbon straight is fine by me, said Dash,
running his eye along the rows of bottles. She nodded and looked at Archer with hiked eyebrows that were as rigid as a pencil, even in the uplifted position, and far darker than her hair. The combination of the two colors for some reason had a deeply unsettling effect on him, as though he were looking at two women instead of merely one.
And you, Mr. Archer?
Whatever you're having, and you can just call me Archer. She nodded, turned to the bar table, and fixed their drinks. Her motions were practiced and efficient, Archer thought, as she jiggered, measured, and mixed. That bar must see a lot of work, he figured. He glanced at another table that was bedecked with framed photographs. He rose and started looking over them. They were all signed either to Beth or Douglas, but none together. There was one of the vice president, and another signed, Best Wishes, Earl Warren. Then he glanced at another one. You know Jimmy Stewart? She turned to him from the bar table.
My husband did. They flew together in the war.
Your husband's a pilot?
Yes, at least he was.
She presented Dash with his bourbon and nothing else in a cut crystal glass. Then she handed Archer his drink.
Dry Manhattan, Archer.
You don't care for the sweet vermouth, then?
She looked impressed.
I like a man who knows his cocktails. For me, it's an essential skill. And no, I care for nothing sweet at all.
Unsure of how to take this, Archer retook his seat and said nothing. She eyed the notepad and pen he had placed on the table.
This must be serious if you're to chronicle all I have to say.
Just standard procedure, interjected Dash.
She took up residence in front of the flames once more and looked down at the two men, her drink held loosely at her side. She was apparently waiting for them to sample their libations. Dash took a sip of his and smiled.
Good bourbon.
From Kentucky. That's where they first distilled whiskey into what we call bourbon, in a county of the same name.
Didn't know that,
said Dash, giving the woman the once-over in a single glance. Archer drank from his Manhattan.
Nice, he said. Thank you.
Dash eyed her closely.
Heard you were ill recently. Appendicitis. You're looking fine now.
How did you know?
Dash glanced at Archer before saying,
Myron O'Donnell is in my building. He happened to mention that he performed the operation.
He was my mother's doctor, too. And many years ago, he saved my father's life after a car accident. That's how I came to use him. He's a fine surgeon.
As soon as she finished speaking, her look hardened like wet cement solidifying.
Now, to business.
You know why we're here?
Said Dash.
In a general sense, yes.
She sipped her drink, and then placed it on a doily set on the timber mantel.
But please, feel free to enlighten me as to particulars.
She picked up a cigarette case from a side table, clicked it open, and extracted a cigarette. Then she placed it into an ivory holder, which she also took from the case, and ignited the end with a platinum lighter that had sat next to the case. She replaced both exactly where they were before. A careful, measured woman, Archer observed, who likes things just so, at least the things she can control. He wrote this impression down. She blew smoke out and picked up her drink, taking another sip. Dash said,
Some of this may be troubling to hear.
Much of what I have to deal with is troubling, Mr. Dash. And people like you and your associate do not get called in when things are not troubling, do you?
I appreciate that you understand the situation.
She took another puff of cigarette and a sip of her drink.
I'll understand it even better when you tell me the particulars.
Archer took another swallow of his drink and eyed the room once more, this time with a nuanced approach.
Everything in this place is for show.
He eyed Kemper, maybe including the woman. He didn't write this down. He didn't have to. Dash laid it all out for her, piece by piece, regurgitating everything that her husband had earlier told them, including his denials of a relationship with Ruby Fraser. Kemper took it all in and drained the rest of her drink, then turned and started toward the table as though to make another, but seemed to think better of it. It was the only moment of indecision Archer had seen in the woman. And from that glimpse, he considered the possibility that she actually might be human, with real blood flowing through her thin veins. She returned to face them in front of the fire, which now seemed to Archer somewhat metaphorical. She perched on the leather-topped fender surrounding the fireplace opening.
"Have you talked to your husband about this matter?" asked Dash.
She took a moment to finish her cigarette and tossed it, minus the holder, into the fire. She dexterously rolled the ivory holder around and around between her thumb and index finger.
"Not really, no. Douglas is running for mayor, I'm sure you know."
"Which makes the matter even more delicate, and the timing suspicious."
The cornflower eyes focused on him with an astonishing degree of severity.
"Mr. Dash, you are not a fool, I take it."
"My worst enemies would accuse me of a lot, and they would be right. But being a fool is not one of them. I've seen too much of life and suffered through quite a bit of it. It strikes foolishness clean from you. At least it did for me."
"Then do not intimate that the timing of the election makes this accusation scurrilous."
"Now that's a $50 word," replied Dash.
"And the only one that comes to my mind to fit the situation."
"Then you believe that your husband did have an affair with Ruby Fraser?"
Her angry look quickly faded.
I don't know about that. I would hope not, but..."
"Did you ask him?"
"No, I didn't."
She paused and studied her shoes.
"Maybe I didn't want to know his answer,"
she added quietly.
"His political opponents would love to make hay out of this."
"Alfred Drake most assuredly knows of it, or at least his associates do, which in politics is a difference without meaning."
"I forgot your father was mayor here, and once took a run at the governor's mansion in Sacramento."
Her lips pursed for a moment. Archer wasn't sure if she was holding back a smile or not. She said,
"He won the mayor's race by a landslide, and lost the governor's contest by the same margin."
"Is there a lesson in that?" asked Archer.
She turned to him, her look now one of amusement.
"Fame and influence are both fickle and localized."
"I'm sure it was a hard loss for your father," said Dash.
"It was, if only because it was the only time he did lose at anything."
"But Drake may be behind this blackmail attempt."
"He may or he may not. I have no idea, really. I actually always thought Alfred Drake was a decent man, but I think that of many people, and I've been proven wrong before."
"If he is the blackmailer, we could use that against him," noted Dash.
"No one expects Drake to win, even with this allegation bubbling up."
Archer spoke up. "Then why would your husband hire us to investigate the matter if it will have no impact on the outcome of the election?" She glanced at him with a look that hit Archer somewhere between his gut and his heart. Her slender tongue slid over the pale, glossy, and full lips.
"An excellent question, to which I have no viable answer. Did you ask him that?"
Dash said,
"I don't usually discourage clients from hiring me, and in our defense, we didn't know the lay of the land yet. But what you said does give me something to chew on."
Archer said, "So you know Alfred Drake, then?"
"I used to go to him for my teeth."
She smiled.
"He's actually an orthodontist, and an excellent one. I think he did a rather marvelous job, taking out some teeth and putting braces on, which straightened the ones that were left. I was hopeless as a child. My father was ready to give up on my having any sort of social life, simply because of the atrocious state of my teeth. But it was my mother who finally put her foot down and took me to Drake.
I hardly think anyone would have agreed with your father's assessment, noted Archer. This did not earn him a second graceful smile. The eyes grew cold.
In many ways, his observation was spot on, because people are invariably shallow, at least here. But you can know nothing of that, so don't bother rendering an opinion.
Archer held up a hand in a motion of acquiescence, and also apology. This also did him no favors with the woman.
You surrender quite easily, Mr. Archer. I hope you're not as squeamish in your work. If so, my husband will certainly be overcharged.
She turned her attention to Dash, as though now totally discounting the value of Archer's presence.
Anything else? Or can you both leave me in relative peace now?
Not unless you can think of anything that might help our investigation.
If I did, I probably wouldn't tell you.
So you don't want to help out your husband here?
If Douglas got himself into this, he can get himself out of it.
I apologize in advance for this question, but is he the sort of man who has the wandering eye?
What man doesn't?
Was her reply.
Well, I think that's it for now, ma'am. Thank you for your time.
She leaned over and pushed a button on the wall. 5 seconds later, the same man appeared to lead them out. As they were leaving, Archer put his notepad and pen away and glanced back at Kemper. She caught him looking and said imperiously,
"Something on your mind, Archer?"
"Nothing wrong with having that second drink now. It might taste better at this point."
"And why is that?"
she asked in a disinterested tone. "You got your piece off your chest and didn't stumble once over your lines. I'd clap in appreciation, except I'm holding my hat." Chapter 27 As Archer and Dash approached the Delahaye, the man who had been washing the Triumph out back came up to them rubbing his hands on a white towel. He was around 35 with a muscular build, good looks, a trim black mustache, and brooding eyes. A short-barreled stogie perched from one corner of his slash for a mouth. He was wearing a white t-shirt and dark brown jodhpurs tucked into leather lace-up boots and a chauffeur's black cap. General George Patton would have been proud of the man's wardrobe choices, thought Archer. Now all he needed were the twin pearl-handled Colt pistols.
"Nice ride," said the man, looking the Delahaye over. "Right back at you," said Archer, pointing to the Phantom and the Bentley. "And I saw you washing the Triumph. Rode in one of those over in England."
The man pinched his stogie and nodded.
"I was over there, too. 101st Airborne. Name's Adam Stover." "Meaning you jumped out of perfectly good airplanes," noted Dash with a grin.
"I was 8th Army," said Archer. "Name's Archer. That's Willie Dash." Stover eyed Archer.
8th Army? And you got your share of killing and nearly being killed?"
"I think we all did."
"You two here visiting Mrs. Kemper?"
Dash said,
"Yes, on some private business."
Archer said, "Nice place." Stover laughed.
"One way to see it. They got more money than God."
"How'd you end up here?"
"I'm from Baytown. Came back after the war. Know my way around cars. So there you go."
He eyed the house and then Dash.
"Seen your billboards around town, Mr. Dash. You're a private dick." "That I am. So is Archer here."
"Got trouble here, then?"
"Again, we're private dicks, so that's as far as it can go, Mr. Stover."
Stover touched the bill of his cap and walked off. As Archer climbed into the car, he glanced at one of the French doors to see Beth Kemper watching him. With his gaze still locked on her, Kemper turned and walked away. As they drove away from the mansion and out through the gates, a marine fog was coming in off the ocean and accumulating like fire smoke in the clefts and fingers of the foothills after already invading the lower canyons. The wind had picked up, and it looked like rain was coming as the temperatures dropped.
"I guess it can get pretty tricky driving up and down here when the mist rolls in," said Archer. "It's tricky driving up and down here at any time, and I'm not necessarily referring to the weather."
"Where to now, Willie?"
"Back to the office. I need to think some."
Archer checked his timepiece. It's still early for me. How about I do some sleuthing on my own?
And how exactly would you go about doing that, I'd like to know?
I wouldn't mind having another go at Ruby Fraser. She's got more to say than she did. I can go back to see her show and talk to her after. I can bring my friend along with me. She's looking for work.
Ruby might not talk to you again, Archer.
She might with another woman there. Let me work it, Willie. You have to trust me at some point.
Right, only I don't know if I've gotten to that point yet, Archer. We did just meet.
I won't louse it up. I'll just be listening.
Dash rubbed his stomach and grimaced in some pain.
You got something going on down there? Asked Archer.
I got something going on lots of places. It doesn't concern you.
If his wife maybe believes he's having an affair, what are we supposed to do about the blackmail angle? And Kemper might very well win the election, affair or not, like his wife said.
The election isn't the thing, Archer. Somebody is committing a crime, and they need to be punished for it.
Now you're sounding like Mr. Shaw.
Dash looked down.
I was a cop for a long time. Sticks to your bones and your brain. But since you're an ex-con, maybe I'm speaking to a wall.
I've got morals, Willie. Maybe more than you think.
And I've got to always keep in mind that I work for the client, not the blindfolded lady holding the scales of justice.
I can see how that might be hard.
If it ever stops being hard, I need to see about another line of work.
So drop you off at the office, then?
Yeah, and keep your eyes on the road. The only place we'll be going is off the mountain, the hard way.
After leaving Dash at the office, Archer turned the Delahaye around and drove back to the boarding house. He passed Madame Genevieve in the hall. She spoke to him with only her eyebrows, which rose toward the ceiling. Is there a problem? He asked.
Your lady friend is very demanding.
Tell me something I don't know. He raced up the steps and knocked on Callahan's door.
Who is it?
Archer.
Come on in.
You decent?
Well, if I were, I wouldn't have told you to come on in.
Even Archer had to grin at that one. He opened the door and closed it behind him. Twirling his hat, he moved over to the bed where Callahan was lying and wearing the same pale, clingy robe she'd had on before. Had a busy day? He began, eyeing her closely. She stretched like a cat, yawned and wiggled a bit, lifting the robe to a fascinating height.
Yeah, I'm worn out just being little old me.
Archer looked at the floor and said, Madame Genevieve says you're a tough customer.
If asking for hot water and a towel is a tough customer, then I plead guilty.
She sat up against the pillow, pulled out a cigarette from her case and lit it. Archer did the same and perched on her bed.
I did run out for smokes. Do you know what they're charging for a pack of Camels? A quarter. It's 18 cents back in Reno. What's so special about this place?
Maybe it's the ocean premium.
Yeah, right. Oh, did you get the job?
Archer nodded. Already working a case.
Why are you here, then?
You still thinking about trying for a job at Midnight Moods?
Yeah, I am. Seems to be the only game in town.
How do you know that?
I haven't been lying here all day waiting for you, Archer.
She swung her legs over the side of the bed so they were sitting shoulder to shoulder. He breathed in her perfume and watched as she crossed one bare leg over the other. He closed his eyes and thought of every sad thing that had ever happened to him. It was almost enough. It gave him a fighting chance. I was there earlier today because the case I'm working has to do with one of the gals who performs out there. I'm planning to go back there tonight, so I came back here to ask if you want to come along with me tonight and see about getting a job out there. Like you said, it's the only game in town. And then maybe you could be there while I talk to the lady again. She might feel more comfortable with another woman there. She rubbed her toes against his pants leg.
You promised you'd take me to dinner.
Her show doesn't start until 10, so we can go there after dinner. And my treat, I'm gainfully employed, and now I have some leads to follow up on. So how about it? Will you come?
Sure, Archer. I'll come.
Great. He rose.
Hey, do you have to rush off?
She eyed her bed.
I'm kind of lonely.
No can do, Liberty. I'm a working man now. She looked resignedly up at him.
You're sure taking this Seamus thing to heart, Archer.
Only way to do it. He tipped his hat and walked out the door, wondering how he'd found the fortitude to do that. Chapter 28 Archer went back to the Dash agency. Morrison told him that Dash had left almost immediately after Archer had dropped him off. Where does he live? Asked Archer. Nearby?
If he hasn't told you, I don't think it right that I should.
Okay. Did a message arrive from Kemper? It was supposed to be a list of people for us to check out.
No, nothing like that.
Do you have Kemper's address, then? I could run over and get the list. Morrison looked at him. Willie knows I'm going to do some investigating on my own.
I know. He told me. He said he was coming to trust you.
She paused, wrote something down on a piece of paper, and handed it to him.
Kemper's address.
Is he going to be okay? Archer asked, taking the paper. He seems to be in pain.
Ulcers. He just needs to rest from time to time and watch his diet.
Morrison opened her desk drawer and took out a black leather card case.
Here.
What is it?
Your ticket. It just came in 20 minutes ago.
Archer looked surprised. But didn't I have to sign something?
I did all the paperwork for you.
Archer opened the case and saw the printed card with his name and other information on it. Aloysius Archer, licensed private investigator in the city of Baytown under the auspices of Willie Dash, Very Private Investigations Incorporated. Licensed under California law, bonded and insured.
The cost of getting it will be deducted from your earnings.
How much are my earnings?
Willie didn't discuss that with you?
No, and I asked him.
Well, I'll have to leave that to him.
He said I should apply for my own ticket because the law might change, and this might not be enough.
If he said so, I would believe it.
He said I need 5 people to vouch for me. He said you would be one of them.
Sure, Archer. Whatever you need.
Just like that?
If Willie said it was okay for me to sign, then that's good enough for me.
Archer left her and looked at the address as he walked down the hall. Kemper's office was on Idaho Avenue. He rode back down in the elevator with Earl, who was not nearly as talkative as before, but just sat on his little chair and read his newspaper. Archer drove to a Rexall drugstore and bought a map of Baytown and the surrounding area. As he sat at the counter drinking a cup of coffee and studying it, the pink-frocked soda jerk girl with a matching cap said,
You looking for some place in particular, mister?
Idaho Avenue?
On the rich side of town,
said the girl. Is that right? She had curly red hair, a skinny frame, and a freckled face with a button nose barely large enough to support both nostrils. She placed her long index finger on a spot on the open map.
We're here, okay?
Right.
And Sawyer Avenue cuts right through the middle of town. Anything to the mountainside is the working class side, at least for the most part. Anything to the ocean side is the rich side, except for obviously where Sawyer's Wharf is. And Idaho Ave is right here,
she added, stabbing the paper with her finger once more. So I guess folks want the water view?
I guess rich folks get whatever it is they want,
she replied gamely. How about up in the foothills? That's not oceanside.
Now that's where the really rich live. See, you don't just get the ocean views up there. You get to look down on the rest of us.
She laughed at her own little joke. You mean like the Kempers? Her freckles seemed to bulge at the mention of the name.
You know them?
I met them today, husband and wife. She gave him an appraising look and adjusted her pink cap.
Old man Armstrong and his family really built up this town.
His son-in-law Douglas Kemper is running for mayor. She shrugged.
Don't know nothing about that. I'm more into flicks than politics.
Archer noted the movie pulp magazine stashed under the counter behind her. Do you know anything about Kemper?
He's got a bunch of businesses. My mom and dad work for him, and my 2 brothers work for him, too.
This got Archer's attention. What sort of businesses?
He builds houses and apartment buildings, for one. My dad's a carpenter with that company. Lots of people moving to this area, and they need some place to live. And he has a vineyard, too, a little north of here. My older brother works there building the casks and working in the grape fields. Ann Kemper owns a members-only country club, the Windward. It's a mile north of here, and right on the water. They have a marina, and folks keep their boats there. My middle brother works there as a valet. He says it's really nice. Ann Kemper owns the Mayport Hotel. That's near Idaho Ave. My mom's a maid there. It's probably the nicest hotel in town.
Sounds like the Kempers only deal in the nicest of everything. He handed her a buck tip. Her fingers closed around it, and she flashed him a smile.
Thanks, mister.
Archer left, fired up the Delahaye, and started off in the direction of Idaho Avenue. He glanced at the passenger seat where he'd placed the map. The traffic was light, and he figured he could make it in under 20 minutes. Baytown was bustling. Archer could see that easily enough. Folks were driving and walking and biking and riding the trolleys that were gold in color and promoted Baytown as the place of paradise. Folks seemed to have taken this to heart and were dressed up and shopping and working and hauling stuff and generally moving both commerce and contentment from here to there with smiles on their faces. Archer passed several dance halls, two buildings advertising card clubs, and a filling station where helpful uniformed attendants pumped gas, cleaned windshields, and gave out shiny toy metal cars to little boys jumping up and down in the rear seats. There was an open-air food market on a patch of green town square, where farmers in bib overalls were offering their wares from the beds of ancient pickup trucks to discerning shoppers. There was a new-looking movie theater playing The Fountainhead with Gary Cooper and Patricia Neal. The fog had burned off down here, and the sun was warm, but the air was still damp and thus chilly. He looked toward the foothills where the Kempers resided and saw higher-level winds swirling up the west-facing slopes and ruffling the canopies of the sea of trees. And up there, silver strands of marine fog still crept into the clefts of the rock, like a thief's hand slipping into a pocket. To his left, the ocean shimmered broad and fine, with seagulls dipping for their meals, and boats puttering along as they made their way to port or away from it. About 100 boats of all sizes were moored in the bay, bobbing up and down to the beat of the Pacific. An airplane, a Western Airlines DC-4, glided along about 1,000 feet above the water, its four propellers whirling in precise synchronization. Archer had flown on the military version of the DC-4 during the war. That brought back memories of a harrowing flight in dense fog that resulted in a crash landing in which not everyone had survived. But since it was World War II, the grunts who did survive got off and took up the fight once more, as though nothing remotely unnerving had happened. He had never really cared for riding in planes after that. He crossed Sawyer Avenue going toward the ocean, and he could see what the soda jerk girl had meant. Even the dogs looked healthier over here, as did the flowers, trees, and bushes, and the sidewalks held not a scrap of paper or other trash. People were clothed in nicer duds. The price tags of the cars cruising along became elevated. Pickup trucks and old dented Fords were replaced with Coupe de Villes, Eldorados, and chromed Buick Roadmasters that looked big enough to live in. The shop fronts were classier and catered to a clientele that obviously had money. Archer had passed one beauty parlor on the other side of Sawyer. It was dingy, with two cracked vinyl chairs, a dirty window, and two old women in their housecoats getting their hair dyed a color he didn't recognize offhand. He'd already passed four beauty parlors on the ritzier side of Sawyer, and each one was nicer than the one before, for each well-heeled patron was greeted at the door with a smile, a handshake, and a symbolic kiss on the behind. Archer slowed down for traffic, and then stopped in front of a shop selling furs. He peered through the front glass and saw a hostess in a long pale green gown and silver shoes catering to an old woman and what looked to be her 20-something granddaughter, while a tall young woman modeled an ankle-length mink coat. Both granny and granddaughter looked enthralled at the prospect of draping the remnants of dead things over themselves. He next passed the Mayport Hotel, which Kemper owned. It was 6 stories high and had twin columns out front, along with a top-hatted doorman in full faux military regalia. A long, pristine burgundy awning was stenciled with the hotel's name in fancy swirls and loops of calligraphy. A cab stand out front was doing a brisk business. Tall windows were on the street side, and an oak revolving door near the end of the left side of the hotel invited folks into the Mayport Bar and Lounge for libations, live music, and good times, or so the sign said. Through one window, Archer could see women in stylish hats and dress gloves
having what looked to be a refined tea in the main dining area. He kept driving, and turned left, and then right, before reaching Idaho Avenue. It was a trim street, shadowed and cooled by a canopy of overhanging trees. The road here transformed from asphalt to cobblestones, and the Delahaye bumped uncomfortably over them. A policeman was on the corner telling traffic where and when to go, and Archer waited his turn until the uniformed gent sent him on his way with a sharp wave of a white-gloved hand. He'd seen 6 prowl cars on the other side of Sawyer Avenue, and not one on this side. As though the rich didn't commit crimes, thought Archer. Yet he also knew that those with lots of money didn't do it in the open, with a gun or knife or a fist, like a working man might employ. They did it in the shadows, 4 layers removed from the actual dirty deed, and nobody came after them, because they could afford the best lawyers, knew all the judges, gave to charity, and had good teeth. He parked in front of a 10-story limestone building that was as neat and refined as the street. The Kemper building, the gold wall plaque outside read. Archer thought Kemper might operate all his myriad businesses out of this place, and then he probably rented the rest of it to other tenants. The receptionist took his name and request and got on her sleek telephone switchboard to call up to Douglas Kemper's office. With that done, she sent him on his way with a suite number on the very top floor. He eyed the marquee in the lobby, and it showed that the place was fully leased to businesses with impressive-sounding names. Overcoming his fear of enclosed spaces, Archer rode an automatic elevator car up to the top floor. It had been a bit easier to beat his phobia this time, because the elevator was mostly all glass wrapped in chrome. He thought Earl from Dash's building might go crazy riding up and down all day in the thing, and he assumed at night that one might get some unsettling reflections. He, for one, didn't want delusions occurring at 100 feet in the air. But then again, they probably exist at street level, too. Chapter 29. A pair of reflective glass doors with platinum wrappers greeted Archer at the entrance to Kemper Enterprises. 2 large rubber plants and 1,000-pound cast stone pots with lions in raised relief on their sides guarded this portal. Since there was no sunlight in the hall, Archer wondered how these beauties could manage. But when he touched them and then smelled them, he realized they were fake. He opened one of the doors and stepped through. It was then that he realized the revealed anteroom was just a tease. There was no one and nothing here. Just 4 walls painted black and a hat and coat rack, stuck in one corner, that was bereft of both hats and coats. The door set directly across from him was thick oak, and he found out it was locked. He saw the buzzer in the voice box, so he buzzed and prepared to use his voice. A woman answered.
Yes?
Aloysius Archer here to see either Mr. Kemper or Mr. Wilson Sheen.
Do you have an appointment?
No, but they should be expecting me. We met this morning at Willie Dash's office.
Oh,
said the voice, and Archer heard what he expected to hear, the door being buzzed open. He gripped the knob, pulled, and stepped into la-la land, at least at first blush. His opinion didn't change much on the second blush. The room was cavernous, awash in light, indeed so much light that stepping from a dark hall into a darker anteroom, and then into this burst of illumination, made Archer's eyes squint, his pupils contract, and his head momentarily pound. The windows were floor to ceilings, and let in as much of the descending California sun as was humanly possible. There was not a drape to be had in the whole space, apparently. There were 6 uniformed desks, each lined up with the other. And on a raised dais behind them was one desk, twice as large as the others. 6 women sat in the lower section. They all looked to be in their 20s, well-scrubbed, professionally dressed, efficient, earnest, smart, ambitious, and platinum blonde right down to the part in the middle of the scalp. They could be sextuplets, down to their bone marrow. Carriage typewriters clicked and clacked, phones rang, and a stock market tape rattled along on one walnut-carved credenza spelling doom or fortune, depending on one's Wall Street position. There was a frenetic energy here that was hard for Archer to wrap his head around. These ladies seemed to be living life at a different speed from the rest of humanity. Since the hat rack outside was empty, he figured they must keep theirs in their desk drawers. The walls were upholstered in what looked to be brown leather 2x2 tiles. On these walls hung paintings of seascapes and landscapes and mountainscapes, as well as other scapes Archer had never contemplated before. A marble statue of a naked woman and baby stood in one corner. Real plants whiled away their time in cast stone pots that dwarfed the ones in the hall. The overhead light fixtures were grand chandeliers, with about 1,000 pieces of cut crystal each, and they looked like a bitch to clean, and even more of a bitch to raise to the ceiling. And that ceiling. It was flat metal copper plates, acid-washed with blue, black, brown, and teal slashes. It looked like something he'd seen Europe before the war took its pound of flesh and everything else. The rug underneath his feet sank in 2 inches under his weight, and Archer didn't think he'd hit rock bottom yet. To Archer's mind, there was too much woodwork everywhere, like an overabundance of makeup on an aging film star. In trying to hide every perceived flaw, it succeeded in wiping out all that was authentic. Yet the whole outfit made Willie Dash's operation look like a plot in a desperate Depression-era Hooverville with cardboard homes and not an ounce of hope in sight. Despite that, Archer found himself preferring Dash's humble space over this over-the-top setup. The large desk on the raised dais was occupied by a very different sort. She was in her 30s, tall and well-shaped, and so brunette that in the sea of platinum she looked like the puppy that had gone lost. Her face held starkly intelligent features, and her eyebrows, as dark as the hair, acted like antennae, sniffing out everything before it became an issue. She was dressed all in black, except for a high white collar and slips of white around the ends of her long dress sleeves. Her hair was thick and wavy and graced her head like a tiara. She had stacks of files on both sides of her desk, a phone in the middle next to an open ledger book, and no typewriter in sight, which told Archer that in addition to her heightened position behind the half-dozen ladies, she was the boss of this little dynasty. And unlike the frenetic activity going on around her, this lady exhibited an aura of languid calm, like the eye of a hurricane. She suddenly harumphed, and one of the platinums obediently rose like a pet on voice command and came over to greet Archer. She was dressed in a tailored brown pantsuit with dark heels, a white blouse, a yellow carnation in her buttonhole, and a splash of yellow in her breast pocket. An earthy-colored cravat was around her throat. She looked like she was just about to step onto a magazine cover for smartly dressed professional women who wanted to take over the world by 1950.
"Mr. Archer,"
she said. "The one and only." The efficient face sparked for a moment, and the lips looked like they might uplift to a smile, but then the moment was gone, and the mask went back on.
"Miss Darling will see you now."
"But I didn't ask to see Miss Darling."
"Yes, please step this way."
Archer stepped that way, and was led up onto the dais and deposited next to the brunette, a.k.a. Miss Darling, as the platinum returned to her glorified niche and commenced to attack her typewriter once more. Darling looked him up and down, perhaps gaining insights into him that Archer lacked himself. He twirled his hat and said, "I'm here to see either Kemper or Sheen."
"Yes, I heard. Take a seat. It might be a while for either Mr. Kemper or Mr. Sheen."
"I only need to see them for a minute."
"That's what they all say. You see that chair over there? Take it, and we'll see what happens."
"And if you just buzz them?"
"You're currently 12th on the buzz list."
"And where are the other 11? Asked Archer.
"They gave up. Let's see how much stamina you have."
"Can you put in a good word for me?"
"Do you have a reason why I should?"
she said. "I'll go smoke a cigarette like a good boy and think of one." This line seemed to please her, even as she deftly waved him off. He sat in the prescribed chair, a leather monster of a baseball mitt that looked like it might reach around and hug him to death, but ended up minding its own business. He slid a chrome ashtray stand over, lit up a Lucky, and tapped ash into it as he gave the place the once-over once more. He came away even more impressed with its organization and blazing efficiency. The platinums worked away like ants on a hill, occasionally venturing to Darling for some reason or another, showing a piece of paper, whispering something,
or in one instance writing something down for her while casting worried glances at Archer. Darling took everything in, her eyebrows flicking and clicking like knitting needles. She made firm decisions and sent the girls on their productive way. He finally stood and wandered over to a large map of the area that sat on a wooden stand and had red stick pins inserted all over. By reading the accompanying information section, he was able to discern that these were ongoing Kemper projects, and there were an enviable number. He caught the Platinums eyeing him from time to time, and Darling once. Each time he smiled, which sent them scurrying back, goggle-eyed, to their work, all except for Darling. She nodded and leisurely returned to what she was doing. Finally, the door opened, and there was Wilson Sheen, dressed just as frumpily as before, with the front part of his shirt coming dangerously close to pulling free of the pants. Compared to the sea of efficient femininity spread out before him, he looked as out of place as a eunuch in a brothel. He eyed Darling, who nodded in Archer's direction. By Archer's timepiece, 2 hours had passed, and it was getting close to dinner time, but none of the ladies had reached for their purses or hats. They continued to work like obedient bees before the queen.
"This way, Archer," said Sheen brusquely.
Archer got up, stubbed out his smoke, and headed up to the dais where Darling said,
"So, you couldn't find a good enough reason, I take it."
"You're just very intimidating, Miss Darling. It set me off my mark." This line seemed to please her more than the first one. She actually smiled, so he could see even white teeth that he thought were as real as the rubber plants outside. The next room Archer stepped into was not much of a letdown from the previous. It was large and comfortably furnished, and its enormous windows had drapes, which were now all the way open to let in the dwindling light. "How'd your guardian grizzly bear signal that I was here?" asked Archer. "She never left her desk or lifted the phone."
"She and I can read minds."
"If that's so, I might be in real trouble with her."
"Something makes me think you're always in trouble, Archer."
"Quite the operation you have out there," noted Archer. "Those ladies seem to move at the speed of light."
"That's what we pay them to do,"
said Sheen, glancing at a file on his desk, a Victorian-era piece that would have looked at home in Buckingham Palace. "You might want to issue them sunglasses. It's pretty tough on the eyes out there."
"Well, at least they won't be catching a nap. And enhanced sunlight is good for productivity."
"Unless you go blind in the process. And I don't think you need the sun so long as you have Miss Darling." Sheen sat down and said abruptly,
"And what can I do for you?"
Archer eyed one door set against the wall, on the other side of which was the outside hall. Sheen obviously used this to come and go without going through the working stiffs. The door set in the far wall, no doubt, led to Mr. Kemper's inner sanctum. He doubted he would get in there. He had run his share of the gauntlet, and it appeared to be ending one room shy of the finish line. He imagined Kemper, as the boss, had at least 2 escape hatches to get out of here without engaging the minions, platinum or not. Archer said, "The list? The one with the people's names who might be behind the blackmail? It was supposed to be dropped off at our office, but it wasn't."
"Right, the list."
He opened a drawer and rummaged through it while his gaze lifted to Archer's. "Hard to see what you're looking for that way," noted Archer.
"What I'd like to know is what you've done so far. And where's Dash?"
"Thinking."
"And you're out what, running his errands?"
"Yeah, my next stop is for the sardines, crackers, and a bottle of Old Forester. You might want to come and join the party." Sheen slammed shut the drawer without taking anything from it.
"We're paying your bill, Archer, so don't play it cute with me. I have neither the time nor the interest."
"Well, I'd like to have back the last 2 hours of my life, but that's apparently wishful thinking."
"We are busy here."
"Yeah, I saw the map out there." "So, the list?"
"What have you done since we met earlier? Give me a report."
"Shouldn't I be talking to your boss?" This comment made one of Sheen's eyes commence to twitch.
"I am Mr. Kemper's authorized representative for all things."
"All things? That's pretty heady stuff. If I were you, I'm not sure I'd want all that responsibility. But to answer your question, we went to see Ruby Fraser." Sheen sat up straight and gripped the front of his desk.
"You did what?"
"She denies any affair happened, and also denies blackmailing Mr. Kemper. She could be lying, of course, and probably is.
But if she denies it, that's good for us.
Sure, why not?
You don't sound convinced.
Neither did she, if you get my drift.
What else?
Asked Sheen, as he drummed his fingers on the desktop. We took a ride up into the foothills and saw Mrs. Kemper. Do you think she's intense, or was it just me?
Are you insane? Douglas will be furious.
For the record, I'm not certain Mrs. Kemper shares Ruby Fraser's opinion that Ruby Fraser is not being diddled by her hubby.
You are a crude man,
he snapped. But?
But nothing. You're a crude and vulgar man. What else did Beth say?
She knows nothing about nothing and really wasn't interested. Sheen nodded.
Well, that's good then.
So that list? Sheen reached into his pocket, pulled out a piece of folded paper, and handed it across to Archer. He unfolded it and looked at the list of names. And there it was all the time in your pocket.
Is there anything else?
Sheen said gruffly. Yeah, when do the girls out there knock off for the day? It's getting late.
Why in the world do you care about that?
I don't. But it looks like they don't know either. And they keep up that pace, they'll be dead by morning. Sheen pointed to the other door.
You can leave this way.
No, thanks. I opt for public entrances and exits at all times. I find it safer. Archer put the paper in his pocket and left. He passed by Darling, who looked at him.
Good meeting?
The best. I might make it a habit. When do you all call it a day here?
When I say we do.
Right. Okay, look me up sometime. I'm over on Porter Street. We'll have a drink. Name's Archer, in case you forgot.
Porter Street?
She said with a hiked brow. Yeah, it's on the other side of Sawyer Avenue. Do a border crossing sometime. We don't bite. At least, I don't.
I doubt we will ever have a drink together, but I will have no trouble remembering your name.
Oh yeah, why's that? She smirked.
You look to be a pretty decent shot.
Then maybe we will have that drink together.
What's your first name?
Aloysius. What's yours?
Well, Aloysius, mine is Wilma.
Wilma, darling. Has a ring to it.
Archer, quit while your head's still above water.
He graced the woman with a smile and a tip of his fedora before winking at the row of platinums. He got smiles back from half. He considered that his best odds since Reno. Chapter 30.
This looks like a nice place. Are you sure you can afford it?
Callahan glanced around the interior of the restaurant called Burbank's. It was all brick with a drive-through portico, white-jacketed and gloved valets, gas lanterns providing flickering light, and a parking lot full of high-dollar cars. It was after 7, and the place was packed with the well-heeled of Baytown in all their glory. Not to worry. Remember, I'm a working man now. He took out his PI license and held it out to her.
Wow, Archer. This looks official and everything.
Hey, if I needed you to vouch for me, sign a document saying I was okay in your book, would you do that? She handed the license back to him.
Why do you need me to do that?
Apparently it's part of being an honest-to-God PI in California.
But I thought you were already licensed. Isn't that what the card said?
He slipped it back into his jacket. It's sort of complicated, Liberty.
Everything with you is sort of complicated.
Look who's talking.
Yeah, sure, I'll do it. Then maybe you can put in a good word for me with Warner Brothers.
She quipped.
Now let's go eat. I'm starving.
They walked arm in arm into the dining area, where they were met by the hostess, who was draped in a silky white number that fell off one shoulder and was barely clinging to the other. Her cleavage was so prominently revealed that even Callahan looked taken aback. The shimmery hostess glided through the sea of tables like a siren to a floundering ship as she led them to a private corner alcove with a built-in banquette seat. She positioned them side by side and looking out at their fellow diners. She bent down and placed the menus in front of them, giving Archer another peek at her bosom. She whispered in a working-class British accent,
You look to me like a gent that doesn't like having his back exposed. Am I right, Gov?
Archer thanked her with a nod, and she sashayed off for her next victims. Archer eyed the drinks section of the menu and glanced at Callahan. She was dressed in a pale blue polyester skirt and jacket with black trimmings,
with a white blouse underneath and dress gloves. A hat with a short veil tacked up to the rim and black 4-inch heels over sheer stockings completed her outfit. Every man in the room had given her the eye, even those there with other women seated across from them. "What's your poison?" asked Archer.
"Champagne cocktail, for starters."
"Remember, we have to work tonight."
"You think a champagne cocktail is going to put me under the table, Archer? Where have you been since we met?"
The waitress came over, and Archer ordered the champagne cocktail for Callahan and a martini for himself. "Bring the onions and hold the olives," he tacked on. They pulled out their cigarettes and lit up, dropping ash into the bowl provided on their table.
"How'd you find this place?"
she asked. "Just looked west of Sawyer Avenue, and there it was, like shooting fish in a barrel."
"You talking code or something?"
"Or something." Their drinks came, and they toasted Archer's new job.
"So, how did this afternoon go? Have you solved the case yet?"
"Not exactly. When I do, you'll be the second to know, right after Willie Dash, unless he gets there first."
"So how's it going with him? You think you're going to learn a lot?"
"The guy's good. Knows the town and the people in it, for the most part."
"What does that mean?"
"It means for the most part." He picked up the menu. "What looks good?"
"You order for me, Archer."
He shot a glance. "Really? Why's that?"
"I'm not used to nice places like this. In Reno, we just had crap, really."
"And you think I'm used to them?"
"No, I mean, I don't know. But you can tell the people in here are somebody. They have class. The men probably all went to college for an education, and the women probably all went to college to find a husband."
Archer eyed the woman closely, because this was the first real hint of insecurity he had seen in her. He tapped her hand. "You're as good as all of these people, Liberty, and don't think you're not."
"Sure, sure, Archer. And I'm the Queen of England, too."
"Where's this coming from?" he asked. "Until we walked in here, I never would have thought you had an ounce of self-doubt or gave a damn what anybody thought about you."
"Shows how good an observer you are."
"I guess," he said. They both ended up with the trout, which was moist and tender, and rice pilaf and a green vegetable that was not readily identifiable to either of them. But it was good if over-salted. Their cocktails were followed by a bottle of wine, recommended by a short man wearing a bow tie and holding a cork opener on a chain. It cost $3, which almost gave Callahan a fit and amused Archer. Archer examined the bottle's label. It had the silhouette of a woman on it that looked familiar to Archer. The wine was called the Beak Hay. On the back, he read off the name of the vineyard that had produced it, Kemper Enterprises. Beak Hay must stand for Beth Kemper. Archer explained who she was and what they were investigating. "Her hubby is a vineyard, and he named the wine after her."
"Well, wasn't that sweet? I guess the louse figures he owes her after cheating on her."
"Could be, yeah. Although I probably shouldn't have told you that. So keep it to yourself." She gave him the eye.
"Gee, what's it worth to you, Archer?"
"See, you keep charging and I keep retreating. Thing is, I don't want you to be disappointed. You have such a high opinion of me and everything."
"You're actually getting funnier, and I mean that."
They finished their meal, retrieved the Delahay, and drove out of town toward midnight moods. It was well dark now, and cool enough to ride with the top up.
"No mountains, right?"
said Callahan. "Scout's honor."
"You were no Boy Scout."
"What do you have in that thing?" She had earlier placed a small, hard-sided piece of luggage on the seat between them.
"Things for the job interview, Archer."
"Okay." They reached Midnight Moods 40 minutes later. It was very different from earlier in the day. The parking lot was packed, the facade of the building was ablaze in neon and spotlights, and the sounds inside reached all the way to the parking lot as they pulled in.
"Gee, this place is dead,"
said Callahan sarcastically. He found a space in the back of the parking lot, and Callahan grabbed her bag. They walked in and looked around. Mabel Dawson, now bedecked in a black sequined number with shoes that matched, greeted them at the door.
"Oh, the puppy dog came back,"
she said to Archer before giving Callahan the long eye.
"And who is your friend?"
"Liberty Callahan,"
said Callahan, putting out her gloved hand.
Archer said you might be looking for some new girls.
Is that right, Archer?
New blood, said Archer. Can't hurt to take a look. She turned to Callahan and gave her an even longer scrutiny.
So, what's your shtick?
Singing, dancing, acting, skits. You name it, I can slot it. And that includes the fast hands and lousy stage timing from the guys.
Dawson pursed her lips and inched up her nose like a smell had come along she didn't care for.
You strike me as being overly confident.
Callahan put a hand on her hip and stuck it out wide like a door opening.
And you strike me as the sort that if I can't cut it here, you'll gladly throw me out on my very cute derriere.
Dawson lit a cigarette and blew a lungful of smoke at Archer. She eyed Callahan through the mist.
Sure, I'll see what you got. But if you get the gig, there's no drinking or drugging on company time. You're here, you serve the house, you get paid a salary. Tips are your business. Whatever else you can earn on your own time, that's your business too.
I've heard the song before.
Dawson eyed the bag.
You're working clothes in there? We got some of our own.
But these show me off the way I like.
Dawson again blew a lungful of smoke at Archer.
You can really find them, Archer. And where's your gumshoe twin?
Thinking.
Right.
She looked at Callahan.
Okay, let's go back to the dressing room, and I can put you through your paces. Sound good?
You sure you can spare the time now? You look busy.
I can teach a monkey to greet people at the door. And I'm not just saying that. I have. Shirley!
She called out. A little minx with bushy red hair flew out of some hidey hole like a mouse stirred by a cat's charge and stood cringing in front of her boss.
Yes, Miss Dawson?
Take Archer here, get him a drink on the house, and find him a seat at the next show. I'll wait here until you get back, and then you got greeter duty for the next half hour.
She glanced at Callahan and said in a syrupy tone,
That enough time for you, honey, or are you a slow starter?
That'll do,
said Callahan.
Where are you coming in from?
Reno.
Casinos?
Sort of.
Well, don't sort of perform for me, or you will get tossed out on that very cute ass, and I'll be the one doing the tossing.
Just so long as we know where we stand,
retorted Callahan. Dawson said,
Don't worry, Archer. I'll have her back to you in half an hour, one way or another.
Before Shirley led him away, Archer said anxiously to Callahan, Hey, you okay with this? She smiled.
Not only am I okay with it, Archer, I'm really looking forward to it.